You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Have you ever wondered who the Mary was from Bloody Mary? If the Loch Ness Monster was real, or if Ouija boards actually worked? On each episode of the family-friendly Unspookable, we look at the histories and mysteries behind your favorite scary stories, myths, and urban legends to get the real stories behind the scares. Want to solve your next mystery? Find and follow Unspookable now, wherever you get your podcasts.
I feel like who Art Ed?
I'm trying to spice it.
Who Art Ed? Mr. Wood, Art Ed, me.
Yeah. Either way, it's ambiguous. It works on art. So many levels.
I know.
That's off to a great start.
Welcome to Who Arted, weekly art history for all ages. I'm your host, Kyle Wood, and joining me once again, I have my good friend, Chuck Hoff, fellow art teacher. Thank you for coming in once again. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
So today, we're going to be talking about probably a lesser-known name, but certainly well-known painting, Gustav Caillebotte's Paris Street Rainy Day from 1877. This is one that I have seen a million times. I'm sure you have as well, because it is at our hometown museum, the Art Institute of Chicago. It's like right there as you're entering the Impressionist section. But Gustav Caillebotte is probably not the best known name from that movement. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah. Even though the Art Institute gives him a full wall. And does a nice job of when you turn the corner, it is the main painting you see as you're walking into that room that seems to be the entry to Impressionism.
Yeah, and I always found it fascinating because, you know, they've got so many different paintings by better-known artists we associate with, like Monet and Renoir and all of that. But Caillebotte is really not well-known, although he's starting to get another look today. And as I was digging into his biography, I'm kind of seeing why. He was kind of an outlier in some ways, although at the same time, in some ways, totally expected biography. I'm going to get into that now. So he's born August 19th, 1848 in Paris, France. And like a lot of really successful artists, he was born fairly successful. I mean, he came from a wealthy and prominent family. His father was a successful textile manufacturer, and he made a lot of money there. But where he really started to turn it from like a nice family fortune to like a Gustav never has to think about money kind of family fortune was Caillebotte's father took that money, a lot of what he had made in textiles, and also invested in construction and development just at the time that Napoleon had ordered Baron Haussmann to begin this massive development project, you know, the urban planning and development that gave us Paris as we know it today. They're doing like the cobblestone streets, rebuilding new neighborhoods, like the buildings of apartments that are like a block long, the sewer system, all of that stuff was happening right around the time that Gustav was born. I want to say it started in like 1853. So basically, it was like the early to mid 1850s through 1870, there's this massive urban development project happening in Paris. And that's where he grew up. That was sort of like the background to his life. That's what he's seeing all around him. And that's what we see reflected, I think, in a lot of the work that was going to come from him. Something I found really interesting when we think about him in relation to the other Impressionists was not just that, like, he had a lot of money, he was also younger than most of the other artists in the Impressionist circle, and he grew up in Paris in that development. A lot of the others, they kind of were a little bit more on the outskirts, they were a little bit older, they had grown up in their formative years knowing a country and a landscape that looked very different and were a little bit more connected with nature. And we see that in his work. We see a lot of stuff that's centered on that urban development. It's very concrete. I mean, we see like people laboring, the floor scrapers, and we see the bridge trusses and all of that stuff. Whereas even something like Monet's painting of the railway station, it was just so focused on like the way that light scatters through the steam and everything like that. It felt a little bit more airy and ephemeral, whereas Caillebotte's work feels much sort of weightier. It's more grounded. It's more, it's solid. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. And I turned the corner, and one of the things that struck me about this particular painting was that it was the day I was having, right? So it was overcast. It felt realistic. It didn't seem to want to glorify the best of our 365 days, but rather give us one that's probably something we experience more often when we go down to the city. So when I turned the corner, I said, yep, like that just happened to all of us as a family. And it, like you said, a painting that is grounded. Well, I mean, to me, it's going to have some elements that make you feel like you can connect with it, you know, as a common laborer. And so like, I'm looking at this and I'm just glancing around, and I know we'll talk more about the painting.
Yeah.
I like that he can connect with his general audience.
Yeah. And I think it is interesting that he's building that connection and that it has this relatable quality to it. And yet I think one of the best things I think you said there that really foreshadows is that idea of turning a corner and being struck by it. Because it has that moment of, you know, it's just a moment in time. It's relatable. It's what you see and experience in the day to day. And yet his work is also so much about turning a corner and the development and bringing us into modern art and modern society in all of these things that were new and fresh and different in Paris in the mid to late 19th century. So just to get back to like that historical and biographical thing, he studied law, earned a degree in law in 1868. He was also trained as an engineer, which I would say probably has something to do with his fascination with the building and the construction and all of that. But he more or less ignored those fields and instead chose to, I'm sure on some level, disappoint his parents by focusing on his real passion, arts. In 1873, he began study at the École des Beaux-Arts, you know, the traditional fine art academy. From what I gather, he only spent, you know, a little bit of time there, because like a year later, his dad passed away. He inherited an absolutely massive family fortune. And that set him up to kind of study what he wanted, how he wanted, learning from other artists. His first painting that he kind of was submitting to the Paris Salon. At that time, you know, the Paris Salon was basically how an artist began their career. It's their introduction. It was the floor scrapers. And if you've seen this painting, it's an odd work for that time, because it is men looking sweaty as they are scraping the floor to like finish the floors in this building that's being developed. And it's just like, I guess in some ways a genre painting, like a scene from everyday life, except for the fact that a genre painting would typically focus on like everyday life in that, oh, isn't this a funny anecdote kind of thing for like wealthy people? It's like a pleasant afternoon kind of scene. And for the middle class, the genre paintings were usually going to be more sort of idealized, nostalgic kind of things. And here he's just showing like, nope, this is what people are doing. They are sweaty. They're enjoying a bottle of wine because that's what's getting them through this mind-numbing, back-breaking labor of scraping the floors. Needless to say, the Paris Salon did not appreciate it. It was rejected. He was hurt by that, as I'm sure all people are when their work is not accepted. But it was an interesting way to try to make his introduction. And after that, he became friends with a lot of other artists that the Paris Salon did not really take too kindly to. That's where he gets in with Monet and Degas and all of those others. He did not participate in the first exhibition of the Impressionists. At that time, they were calling themselves like the Society of Independent Painters, Printmakers, Engravers, or something like that. That was just really long-winded. It became the Impressionists after that first exhibition where critics were just ripping them apart, specifically Monet's Impression Sunrise. That's where the name Impressionist comes from. A critical review called it the Exhibition of the Impressionists. But Caillebotte sort of saw those people who were doing something new and different and tackling these more sort of contemporary themes in their work. And he said, yes, these are my people. I want to be painting with them. And he did. He continued making just what he wanted throughout his life. He never really sold his work. He participated in a few of the Impressionist shows, but not the ones where collectors started to find the market for Impressionists, which I think is probably why he became less well known. When the dealers started to come around to the Impressionists and they found a way to make it profitable, that's where Caillebotte was just like, I don't want the headaches. I don't want to deal with this. I don't want to deal with the commercial aspects of it. He did participate in the commercial aspects in the sense of buying Impressionist paintings, especially when like nobody else was. He was buying from his friends and built up this massive collection, but he didn't really care to sell his stuff, which nice if he can get away with it.
Yeah, for sure. And I think one of the ways I can contribute, you know, to this podcast in what you've just described is trying to understand the person. And I found myself, I grew up on the south side of Chicago for the first 14 years, and my parents and grandparents just worked so very hard. Like they took the buses in and out of Chicago, my grandpa. And he worked at a hotel and he was a maintenance guy. And he was 50, 60 hours, and that didn't count the travel. And I just thought to myself, like, as I go into the city and I see laborers, you know, I tend to see the vendors. I tend to see the people who I know will spend 12 to 15 hours down there trying to sell, you know, maybe $100 worth of food. And mm-hmm. I don't know what it is about me in my past, but I tend to see that first, or at least I do a character study. Like I enjoy going to Chicago to see all of the different aspects of what's going on in the city and how people survive. And so I was thinking about this, and I was thinking about the way you had brought up in earlier episodes about Wassily Kandinsky and how it parallels a little bit with their career choices and when they split from wanting to be something. I think in his case, it was like also maybe a lawyer.
Law and economics. Yeah.
Yeah. And so here he is. He saw dad, he saw the fame, and he understands that, you know, his path could be pretty easy. But I don't think he'd be able to study his characters, you know, the people in his story, if he gets too far from where it all starts. And so I've listened to a lot of different podcasts and interviews. And one that comes to mind is Harrison Ford, you know, who's in a Star Wars movies. in Indiana Jones movies, and he's so irritated because people recognize him. And when that happens, it breaks the chain of collecting more information to make his characters more relevant when he does his movies. So, you know, I think it kind of, for me, that's how I connected, you know, today's artist, because I thought, you know, he wants to be with the people, or at least it seems that way. And I was just fully fascinated with that, because he was handed the keys to the wealth, and his life could have been, you know, pretty much scripted for him. But then in return, he may not have the paintings that he was able to produce. And then, of course, all the support he gave to fellow artists, you know. So,
yeah, I mean, to be clear, he accepted that fortune. he used that fortune, and he lived a comfortable life. He, you know, had a lovely home and an impressive collection and the studio and all of that sort of stuff. And he was a boating enthusiast. He was like, you know, he loved a good yacht. Actually, in the boating, I think you and I actually talked about Renoir's Luncheon of the Boating Party. Gustave Caillebotte is actually pictured in the luncheon on the boating of the boating party. Yes. I'll link that in the show notes. He's like in the bottom right corner, I believe. But he enjoyed, like, he spent his time on hobbies that we very much would associate with the upper class. You know, he's stamp collecting and all of that sort of stuff. But in his work, and I think this is the sort of engineering part coming in, like, he had that engineering training as well. We see a lot of urban development. We see, like, the bridges with the trusses, and he's getting into details of these structures. And the architectural details that we see in those buildings. And I think in a lot of ways, even going back to the laborers, he's just fascinated by how all of this comes to be, that this massive project is undertaken. And what I like is that he is recognizing it's not just the steel that makes the building. It's the people who put in those hours and who do that manual labor, scraping the floors and whatever, like that all of this stuff is coming together because of all of these people making their contributions. You know what I'm saying? And I think in some ways his work is about these intersections of people in society and the new buildings being developed, the architecture, the technology, and how that's changing day-to-day life for people throughout the city.
Yeah, I love in your writing and research, you had mentioned that the street we're looking down was, you know, 20, 30 years before a hillside, like a little hill in the background. And I can appreciate the fact that, you know, as someone who's into the engineering, you can see the cobblestone bricks laid a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And the focus of the painting is, you know, we're looking at a building split right there, you know, right in front of us, where you could take your eye down one street and down the other street. So it forms, you know, a 2-point perspective within a, you know, pretty flat middle ground. So you have a middle ground, but then you have, you know, some complexity. He wants you to take, you know, he wants to take the viewer down both sides of the street and lay the cobblestones in the direction they are. So he didn't, I just feel to me like he didn't cheat any part of this. And he could have, because it's pretty labor intensive. And I really appreciate the complexity of this painting as I took myself around a couple of the rooms at the Art Institute, and the ones that stood out were the ones that I think had some heavy math in it.
Yeah.
Because I can just appreciate a couple elements as we are teaching our students who have heavy math backgrounds. It's a great way to tie in some extra, you know, subjects to where they're even more intrigued and fascinated.
Yeah. And so as long as we're starting to shift towards this, let's leave it right there for a moment. Let's take a quick break. And then after that, we're going to get into probably Caillebotte's most famous painting, Paris Street Rainy Day from 1877. Okay, so now as we're looking at Caillebotte's Paris Street Rainy Day, huge painting from 1877. I mean, this is about life size. These figures, when you stand there, you feel like you can just walk into the space. And as we've already talked about, there's a lot going on here. But as you look at this, what's jumping out at you?
So first thing I did when I was talking to my family, and we ranged from 2 12-year-olds, a 14, and a 16-year-old at the moment. You know, my 18-year-old's off to college. And we just wanted to, I said to him, I said, the first thing that struck me is the wagon wheel. And the wagon wheel, I thought it was interesting because here he is, an engineer. And you know, he could have went ahead and just painted every aspect of the wagon wheel. And this will be in the painting, it'll just be to the left.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And so I got to be within inches, you know, I think it's a foot before you set the alarms off. And I'm staring at it, and I told my kids to stare at it. And I said, he didn't paint everything. You know, he painted the width of the base of each spoke and let it kind of disappear in some spots. And I said, this gives you that atmospheric space,
mm-hmm.
you know, where your eye just cannot realistically grab the entire wheel. And because of it, it works at just about any distance, but particularly from where he probably thought people would be looking at this painting, 10 to 15 feet out. And as you move within a foot, then you start seeing why it's working and how much information he's leaving out. And that to me was brilliant. I wanted to start there.
Yeah, it gets a little bit hazy. As you say, there's this little bit of that atmospheric perspective where the people in the foreground are pretty well defined. Like, we can see the buttons on the vest. We can see, you know, the hairs on the head. We can see the lace on the woman's face. And I'm, of course, talking about the figures in the right-hand side. But then as we look across and back through the painting, things become less defined because, as we all know, things closer to us don't just look bigger. We see them in sharper detail, and things kind of fade into this gray, especially on a rainy day. He's capturing the effects of light, and on the wagon wheel, it's I think of the way that when you watch a car in motion, the wheels, like, it's overwhelming to the eye to process. You can't see the spokes so well. And I think he's actually kind of capturing that sense of motion a little bit there by just having these little yes. flicks. I agree there. And
it's much like with stop motion, when you try to convince, you know, students that, you know, 8 to 10 pictures allows that little bit of a trick of an eye. They understand it's still stop motion, but you're more accepting of things disappearing and being crunched, and you accept the line of motion, and you accept that there would be just a little bit of blurriness as the object's moving across. That's where he's at.
Yeah.
You know, this is not obviously a Tesla. This is a carriage wheel. So the carriage wheel, you're still going to understand that there's spokes, whether it's parked or moving, but it's going to be moving at a pretty slow rate of speed, so you could probably distinguish them.
I also think it's funny, like, when you look at that carriage, that it throws me off. It feels so cut off. Like, I have to imagine there's, like, some sort of bar that I just can't see that's connecting to the horse out in front of it. But it just, it feels like, and maybe this is because the figure is walking in front of that, you know, it feels like that carriage is not supported. There's nothing to propel it forward. It feels like I just see the back two wheels, like a rickshaw or something like that, you know? And also that sense of things being cut off and blocked from our view, that's something that's really striking to me about this. It feels like a snapshot, not just because people are in motion, but also because, like, when you look at the man on the right-hand side, and when I say right-hand side, for us as the viewers, my right, who's basically just walking into frame. I mean, he is cut off. We only see half his umbrella, half of his head, like half the body, one arm. That's strange for that time. It's typical in a photograph because the camera is always seeing just some stuff in the field of vision. But in traditional paintings, they would always compose it so carefully so that we can see everything that we need to see and every person that we need to see. And that idea of having someone cropped at the edge and running out of the picture plane, that was something that felt sort of fresh and modern and a composition influenced by photography. Because photography was an invention of the mid-19th century. And really, even at this time, while they did have a camera, you couldn't take a snapshot of the street at that time. It wouldn't have color, and you wouldn't be able to capture it fast enough to capture the motion. It would have been blurred. You know what I'm saying? It would probably be about 10 years later that the technology would be there for them to be able to really take a snapshot of this kind of scene. You had to have a painting worked on for months and months and months to get something that feels like a moment in time.
Well, it's funny because whether it was an accident or not, you know, if he had set up his easel and, yeah, you know, realistically the camera set that up, the only two people that are, you know, probably the most attentive to something obstructing their view or obstructing their path are the two people to the left of the person that was cut off with the umbrella to the right. And so they're like literally almost stopped and looking, you know, off their shoulder. Everyone else is doing about what I would expect them to do. As you know, it's drizzling, you're looking straight down.
Yeah.
You know, you want to make sure you don't, you don't get wet or you take your eyes off and hit the curb. So, you know, I'm looking around that painting and I'm saying, okay, there is, you know, he definitely captured two people stood there and are doing something a little bit different than everyone else. So I could appreciate that. But he was careful not to do that with too many people because it has to feel like the city. It has to feel busy. It has to feel like people are trying to get to their destination. You know, yeah, what I mean? It's not like staged, like the Dutch had done earlier with like famous figures and kings and queens. It's, there's nothing staged. And that's that seems to be a break from earlier periods, where you just felt like it was staged and, like you said, the entire body is in, mm-hmm, or the main part of the subject. So that's another part I can really appreciate.
Yeah, and it's interesting you bring up those figures on the right-hand side, how they seem to be looking off to the side, oblivious to the fact that the guy coming in who's cropped at that edge is clearly going to run into them. I mean, their umbrellas look like they're touching. It looks like he's about to elbow that woman in the face as he walks by. And it's just, it's an interesting thing because it looks, it builds some tension for me. It feels like someone needs to move because they're going to run into each other. But in a lot of ways, this is all about that sort of intersectionality. I mean, it's literally an intersection. We see this is a composition of all of these people going different directions and roads going different directions. And we see different types of people. Mostly we're focused on these middle class and upper class people who seem nicely dressed. But when you look a little bit deeper into the painting, like that couple that's in the foreground that grabs your attention right off the bat, when you look between them, there's a dude holding a ladder, like maybe a painter or other laborer who seems to be walking to do his job, probably. Like, there's this mix of different types of the upper class and the working class. And that was also something that was kind of different, that these people in different stations in life are all using the same streets. They're all walking together through the city and commingling. That was sort of one of the hallmarks of this period and urban life in Paris at that time.
Yes. And, you know, as you scan through a little bit, I found some of the buildings, you know, it was, I want to look beyond the umbrella. Mm-hmm. And he took one half of this painting and he made that the foreground, like you said, and that tension is there. And if you look just beyond the tension, you see the only boy that I can see that he put in there. It's right on the street mm-hmm. corner off the long pole of the umbrella. And so then I'm trying to figure out, is it a weekend, you know, or are we, you know, did she just come down because she needs to run business, you know? Like, so it's, to me, I'm fascinated by everything in the picture. And I find it to be pretty consistent. The one thing I found that was kind of interesting is the cast shadows. I can tell he really worked to figure out what the cast shadow needed to be for it to be an overcast day. Because I think it would have been really easy to put like a pretty dramatic cast shadow to make sure everybody's standing on the ground. And at first I thought maybe this was underpainted. Like I was trying to figure this out, like particularly the person, there's a couple between just to the side of the wagon. So you have the wagon wheel and you have the couple and they're floating. They barely have a cast shadow. But then when I started to think about it, I said, there is hardly a highlight in this painting as well. So it stayed right in that middle kind of muted area. And he stayed pretty consistent. So I really appreciated that, you know, particularly the lamppost at the corner where it was pretty defined detail. And then it blurred towards the foot of the painting. And I knew that to be true because that's where my eyes would pick up standing water.
Yeah, there's a lot of subtlety to these variations because, yeah, on a hazy day, a rainy day, everything gets into this sort of mid-tone range. But he's got just enough contrast, just enough little pops where it still works as a composition. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's a difficult thing when so much of this is in this mid-tone. He still gets the deep enough black on the top hat and the shadow under the umbrella on the, you know, the two men walking on the left-hand side. Like, there are just enough, like, of the dark darks and just enough little highlights to define things, to give it a sense of volume and give us a clearer focal point. That it does work compositionally. The other thing that I'm noticing just compositionally is the asymmetrical balance in it's weird because there's some points of symmetry, like that building that's like the model of two-point perspective. That building feels symmetrically balanced, and the light post is like centered, giving us almost like an axis of symmetry. And on some level it feels like it's asymmetrical, but on some ways it does also feel balanced. It's working, you know,
it is working. And I know it's the movement of the characters and they're leading us to the other half of the picture. I think if their eyes and their faces were looking straight at us, I mean, it may have run a different course, because I know you teach this well, because my kids that come to me know this well. And that is, you know, the rule of thirds. And as you're looking at the rule of thirds, this would be like textbook cut the painting in half in both directions. There doesn't seem to be a third in this. So why does it work? And that would be a great that'd be a great conversation to have with students, because it's hard to get away with this and not have it be less interesting than someone who followed the rule of thirds. And for me, it's because of the characters, and it's because of the consistency.
Yeah.
You know, because all the characters and all the it's muted, and it's because of the complexity. Like I particularly like all of the angles of the lines and buildings and space. He just does a wonderful job. But when if you first look at it, you're like, is it just me, or did he just make two separate paintings?
You know, the other thing that I'm noticing, and I'm just now realizing this as you talked about the figures and how they tie it together, the figures, I'm noticing where we can see their faces, they're all following that compositional guide of having your subject looking into the frame. The figures on the right-hand side are looking to my left. So they're looking at the something, you know, presumably across the street, but they're as I look across to see what would they be looking at, I kind of then start to see like, okay, empty street, but then I see these two figures on the left-hand side who are looking in towards the center as they're crossing the street, just like the guy who is essentially central to the composition is looking in towards the center of the frame. Like he's looking at the curb, which would be blocked by the view of that central light post. But everybody seems to be looking into the frame, which helps to redirect my eye in different directions, but always deeper into the picture.
It's funny because, you know, come 10 years later, you wonder if this painting, you know, was exhibited enough to influence like the Sunday afternoon painting that is also featured at the Art Institute.
Oh, Sunday on the Grand Jatte, the Seurat.
Yes. Which all the characters are facing one direction, minus a character or two facing the viewer directly. And so I know, you know, this just becomes a study anyway. And this is probably a formal art class, or many of them, that, you know, you're taught to keep people inside your painting. I particularly want that to be the emphasis. But I just love that in the 1870s, he painted this. Mm-hmm. Because I can't help but think like it probably influenced for 20, 30 years, paintings like this probably influenced each other to get to where we're at today.
Yeah. That's interesting. Just to tie some stuff together, since you referenced the Sunday on La Grande Jatte, that was my understanding of it is that Seurat had basically like two paintings that almost feel like companion pieces. You have like the Island of La Grande Jatte, and then you have like the Bathers that it looks like they're on the other shore. And it's like, you know, the upper sort of middle class and people who are sort of layabouts and trolling and stuff like that. And then there's the lower working classes where they're on the other bank, and you can see the factories and the smoke behind them. And they seem to be looking out at each other if you looked at them. And then there's that little girl who's like looking out at us, the viewer, who is just like, what is going to become of these people? you know, but you also referenced like if this was exhibited enough for it to have influenced Seurat. I'm not sure about that, because he put this, if I recall correctly, in the second exhibition of the Impressionists. And I found it interesting. A critic said something to the effect of Caillebotte is an Impressionist in name only because he's the only one in his circle of friends who knows how to draw. And and clearly they're forgetting about Bert Morisot, who was very accomplished and, you know, had the stamp of approval from the Paris Salon and everyone else. But after that, like, he exhibited in a couple of the Impressionist shows, but as I said, he didn't really sell his works. He didn't sell much of any of his works because he just didn't need the money. Why bother? Like, he just had these paintings to show when he wanted and then just kept them in his home because probably he liked them. You invest a certain amount of time and effort in these, it's hard to give it away. And then his influence, I think, was probably diminished to some extent because of that, because he wasn't selling work. It wasn't going out into a whole bunch of galleries and collections where other people could see it. Although he was critical to the success of others, because he bought a bunch of paintings. And then when he passed away fairly young.
Yeah, 45 years. Yeah.
He, when he passed away, he basically left his collection of Monet and Degas and, you know, other paintings by the Impressionists to the nation of France. And so the Musée d'Orsay got a ton, dozens and dozens of Impressionist works in their collection from Caillebotte. But his paintings, I believe he left to his brother, probably because it would feel a little bit egotistical to be like, museum, here are my works, you know. But the fact that he didn't exhibit as much, didn't sell so much, it didn't make its way through different people's collections, kind of diminished his star a little bit. And then as he gave so much great art by so many different great artists to the museums, a lot of articles came out saying, like, Caillebotte was this great collector. And look at his collection that has shaped art history and how he has supported these other people. So it became like he was a footnote in the life of Renoir and Monet and those others. But really, he was much more than that. But I guess we're probably at that time where we got to start to wrap this up. So where do you think this one belongs? Is this one for the Louvre? Is this one for the lab? Or is this one for the Louvre?
It's the Louvre for me. I think, to me, because it stands alone, it comes early in a movement. It wasn't something that everyone recognized. I also love the fact that there's so much complexity, that when you walk into a room and it's massive, you walk in a room and it's a showstopper. I think the Art Institute feels this way, and the reaction I had around me, that made me feel that way too. Like, I wasn't alone in feeling this.
Yeah, I have to agree. I think it is a stunning piece. I love the composition because it really draws you into that world. You know, it's a great piece for the entry to a wing of a museum because of the fact that you feel like you can just walk right into that space and you want to. It's bringing you into that world. It's also significant because it feels like a transition between sort of traditional painting styles and more modern impressionist methods. It doesn't have quite the loose brushiness of most impressionists like a Monet, but it does have a lot of the same characteristics and the same goals with capturing the world as it was, as we saw it on a rainy day, the highlights and shadows, the reflections on the water and all of that sort of stuff. And I also think it has aged beautifully. In its day, it was about modern life and this transition to the new city and the new way of living in the world. I mean, everything about it was new. Even the umbrellas, like the collapsible umbrella or whatever, that was new technology at the time. There's so many things that, like, to us feels quaint and old and traditional, But at the time, it was new and exciting. And the fact that all of that stuff has held up so well, that it gives contemporary audience, you know, going on almost 150 years later, it gives us a feel of like warm nostalgia, and we can kind of see, oh, that's how I imagine Paris. And at the same time, it was bold and innovative and new. Like, it managed that transition very well. Like, it doesn't feel dated in an odd way.
Well, and you know, if you count the chimneys, you probably have 30 or 40. So if it's not a rainy day, it might be quite, you know, smoky and industrial.
Yeah.
So there is something to this that, you know, you said 150 years. Well, I'm looking for the part of the city that looks like that today. And because I, you know, you dress warm, you dress well, you can't wait to go downtown. You want to catch the sights, and it makes it a little romantic, to be honest with
you.
There's a reason to put the husband, wife, or, you know, a girlfriend, boyfriend together right there front and center. This is a trip into the city. It's a special trip. And, you know, and they're enjoying their time, even though it's raining. This is the window. We can't wait to get down here. Let's see all the new changes. And so, yeah, I can appreciate that.
Yeah, it works in different ways. And, you know, no matter what the time period, it feels like every audience is seeing something good in it. And I think that's what makes it such a fantastic museum piece to cherish for the ages. In addition to his, you know, significance to the movement and his contributions through his painting and his collection, because both do matter. But thank you so much for your contribution today. I really appreciate your taking the time, as always.
Oh, yeah. My pleasure.
This concludes this week's episode of Who Arted, part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. If you found this tolerable, please leave a rating or review on your favorite podcast app. You can find images of the work being discussed this week and every week on social media at Who Arted Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok, and of course on the website whoartedpodcast.com. Podcast done.